We're going to be on B26. We're going to start there. So last night we looked at the thinker. Tonight we're going to look at the feeler. Probably get through feeler doer to some degree. Okay, B26, section B, page 26. At the bottom of the page it says feeler. The feeler. You remember what we said, that the feeler, for the feeler, their relationships then equal their identity, that they, how their relationships go determine how they feel about themselves or don't feel about themselves. They're very highly subjective, often saying, I didn't say that. You know, everything's written through a good of emotion. My mother is a feeler. And she's a compulsive feeler. And so I like to tell the story that she, and I'm sure she'll deny this, but I can remember after our first child was born, the second child was born, we were standing in my kitchen, and you know, some of you know I have six brothers and sisters, and I'm number four out of six. And my mother said, we were just doing something, having good fellowship, and she said, you know, Tim's always been our favorite. Well, Tim is number five. But here she is talking to number four. And I'm just sitting there going, okay, now what am I supposed to do? How am I supposed to process that comment? You know, exactly. Because we weren't having an argument or anything else. And so she was, it made sense in her mind. It didn't really make sense in mine. So anyway, she would probably say, you know, I didn't say that, but what she meant was she didn't mean that. She meant something else. I still have to figure out what it is, but she did mean something else by that statement. So a lot of times, you know, they say something, they don't necessarily mean what they say, but the words didn't just come right out the way they wanted them to. And I kind of liken a feeler, if they don't have much thinker with them, is that, you know, the words, as they come in their mind, they do not pass go, do not collect $200, and go straight out the mouth, you know. And they like to hear what they say to see if it's right or wrong, kind of. You know, I think they kind of do that. So they tend to put their foot in their mouth quite a bit. They tend to be very talkative types. And feelers, generally, by the time that they're five or six, are fairly good communicators. They've had a lot more practice than everybody else. And so by the time they're a teenager and get into college, they've talked enough where they're pretty interesting people to listen to, because they can just, you know, they can wind a good story and do a good job of it. And they really do a good job of it. And did you notice, for those of you who have met Mike, that there's a little bit of feeler in there? Can wind a good story? This, not Mike Deason here, but Mike Wells. Mike can do that too, by the way. Wind a good story, can't you, Mike? So they'll pout when they're rejected. Here's just some basic characters that will follow the morals of the crowd. And see, interesting thing about a feeler is they want acceptance very bad. They want that relational acceptance. And so they tend to be very, they say that they're very persuasive, but what they really want is you to agree with it. That's really what they want. So whatever product they happen to be selling, they want you just to agree with it. And so that makes them fairly persuasive. But because of this agree with mentality, then, you know, somebody says, hey, let's go, you know, let's go spray paint cars. Now, you know, do it in the U.S., not in Thailand. But, you know, let's go do that. And or something, and they may find themselves actually doing something like that, doing stuff they would not normally dream about doing, just to go along with the crowd. For them, life is a party. You know, their main question, just for a feeler that's a very high feeler, is it fun? Or, you know, that's how they evaluate stuff. In variety, they tend to like variety in a lot of things. When a guest enters the home, the guest is made to feel important, and the family gets left out. And I like to tell the story of whenever I go home to my mother-in-law's house, just before Christmas, it's about a 9-hour drive. I get all my talking and fellowship with my wife out of the way for the next week. Because as soon as we get out of the van, I kind of kiss her goodbye and she goes in and she's with her family. And then we fend for ourselves for the next week because she's off visiting here and there and doing this and that. She's very social. And then we can talk about it when we get in the van to leave and go back for the rest of the time. They generally are very forgiving and they'll allow others to fail them. You know, they don't necessarily like it, but they really forgive and forget. They have a short memory when it comes time to the fault for others. They manipulate to allow you to have his way. Just another way of saying they're pretty good at it. You think they can make you think it's your idea? That's pretty good. They're extremely sensitive then to the needs of others, and they can empathize easily. So if you look at spiritual gifting, a lot of times you'll see people will get classified as mercy showers when they're feelers, automatically, because of this empathy. Reject them and they'll reject you back. See, they hate rejection, so if they want to show that, what do you think they do? They reject you right back. They have their moment-by-moment explosions. And see, that's something I could never quite understand, is that if they get angry, they show you right away, but then it's over. It's finished. They don't even think about it anymore. But thinkers tend to be slow burners. They think about it and think about it and think about it. Then they may explode. But with feelers, they can explode and it's over. It's done. And they move on to something else. Becoming born again is often the explosive type. They tend to be very motivational, enthusiastic. They desire popularity. They like freedom of expression. So they don't like an atmosphere where they have to keep it all within. Some working atmospheres, there's not a way that you can verbalize something, so they need to express to people and talk and so forth and so on. And they can then easily verbalize feelings because, in general, they've had a lot of practice at it. They've done it for long. A lot of misunderstandings about the feelers is they oversell you on anything. They react to a person. And, by the way, as we go through these again, if you sense that one of these is you, put a little check by it. These are just kind of expansion on the test. They react to the person and not the facts. And what that basically means is that if you're in a room full of people, and it's a room full of people of thinkers, how much laughter and stuff are you going to find? Not necessarily a lot, because they're busy processing and thinking. And so if a feeler will walk into that room and say, boy, something's wrong. So they may just automatically react to the person itself because they're not very expressive and say, well, something's wrong with that person. When in fact, they're just thinking. When others enter a room, you can feel they've cast you aside. So that's not their intention. So you can be talking, and I don't know if this has ever happened to you before, but I've actually been talking to somebody, and mid-sentence, they'll turn away and say, hi, George, how you doing, and walk away. And you're just kind of going, okay. This was very important, I can tell. You know, this conversation I was having with you. They can become overcommitted because they can't say no. They're people pleaser. They want to always say yes to those things. Under pressure, they become sulky. They'll physically reject you because physical rejection hurts him. He assume it will hurt you. It comes back to that principle that how I view myself will be how I view others. How I feel that a person treats me will be the way that I'll treat another person. They become very subjective under pressure, which means very feeling-oriented. They try to read their feelings. They accept blame and withdraws from others into themselves. They become depressed. Now, a good question to ask here, just kind of a little side note, is what we're saying here, this is what feelers do in general. This isn't necessarily the right thing. These are just what feelers do in general, because when you look at this and you bring it before the Spirit of God, there's going to be some conflict, isn't there? There should be. So this is a feeler, just a plain old vanilla feeler. And we're not including the Spirit at this point. Okay? In affection, hug him 100 times and he wants one more. Well, just one more hug. nearly impossible to meet their physical need for affection. Give him a hug each time you pass by. He greases himself to scheme. So, on page 28, they need plenty of activities with others. And after they're completely drained, they will withdraw to rest. So feelers do get feeled out. And they do need to withdraw to rest. They must be constrained to concentrate on the task and the facts. In other words, they do have a hard time concentrating and keeping their concentration on that particular task that they have set before them. Another thing about feelers that's not here is that feelers tend to have the pile disease. What I call the pile disease. There's a pile of stuff here and a pile of stuff here and a pile of stuff here. And, you know, I'm going to get around to organizing here one of these days, so I'll just pile it over here. So they tend to have the piles, if you will, the pile disease. Give them the opportunity to do something special. They like that. And for them, time equals love. You communicate love to a feeler by spending time with them. That's what they really like. They fear complex relationships. They don't like complex relationships. They always have to be thinking and walking on eggshells and so forth and so on. They fear pressuring people. You know, they're really can be persuasive and enthusiastic, but they don't want to pressure anybody. They want to put themselves on somebody. If they feel that they've harmed someone, boy, that really bothers them. They don't want to harm anybody. And they also fear a fixed environment, which is also called a schedule. They don't like those very much. Okay? In the relationship with God, they have a constant feeling of rejection. Now, does anyone care to guess why they have a constant feeling of rejection? They don't feel it. How physical is God? Well, God, you know, that's a big debating question. We can get into the theological implications of all this stuff, but it's hard to feel a lot of hugs and pats and affirmations from God, right? And so because of that, see, feelers go on a lot of hugs and touches, and, you know, they're very tactile type of people. You know, they tend to be the huggers, you know, and so because of that, their relationship with God, they can almost feel a constant sense of rejection from God. Why isn't he down here hugging me? You know, letting me know his presence. And that's why, for instance, for them, they must really spend a lot of time with the Lord, because time equals love, right? So they really do need to keep that relationship with the Lord. A feeler must learn to live out of the fact, not the feeling. That's an important issue for them, of who God is. He must see that it is possible to have a deep relationship with God so that he's done a lot, does not allow other people to crowd out God's importance. He wants to run from God when there has been a failure. Okay, because he doesn't want to be rejected automatically. Just, oh man, God's going to get me. They want to feel God before they believe. So they said, God, if you let me experience you and feel you, then I'll believe. And God says, no, if you believe, then I'll let you experience me. It's the other way around, for without faith it is impossible to please God. They tend to equate God's presence with feelings. And, well, how did you know God was there? Well, because I felt it. So God was present. So, you know, if you have goosebumps, then God's there, type of a thing. The value to the kingdom, they're in touch with the hurts and needs and feelings of others. Since the majority of believers act from fact, not feeling, input from the feeler helps keep the heart in the outlook and direction of ministry. So, you know, one of the most frustrating things with a lot of feelers, especially for a thinker, is you say, well, what's wrong with that? And they'll tell you, something's wrong with it, but I can't tell you what it is. They sense that something's wrong. You might want to call it even an intuition, that something's not quite right. But they don't have a lot of facts to back up their intuition. And so one of the things that, you know, that's valuable in the kingdom, just because all the facts don't line up doesn't mean you go through the door necessarily. They will see the good in others and desire to give them one more chance. How many more chances? One more chance. And the thing is one more chance is always one more chance. You know, continually on and on and on. So that's a perpetual thing. They have the ability to encourage and enjoys that role. They like to encourage other people. And they tend to lead through persuasion, believing things will get better. They are the eternal optimist. They do see that. They're forgiving of other people in general. And vocationally, of course, they like any people-intensive job. And in selling, management, people helping professions, and they need variety and change. And one thing I wanted to add there is that's one of the things in their relationship with God is that they have a variety in their relationship with God. In their way that they relate is really important for a feeler. Thinkers tend to like schedules. A fellow that led me to the Lord gave me it was called the Australian Plan, which was just a plan on how to read through the Bible once a year by reading out of three different parts of Scripture. Well, from 1973 till 1993, I read through the Bible every year. Every year. Through that whole time. And I just loved it. It was the greatest thing since sliced bread. But my wife could never do it. She's a feeler. She just got totally bored with something like that. So what she does is, you know, she may sing hymns this morning and one morning, and then she may spend another morning in Psalms 139, and she may read all of Ephesians another morning. She just may do nothing but walk and pray the next morning. She likes variety. And you know what? That's okay. Because she's still doing what she's still relating to the Lord. But she just likes variety. She doesn't like to go through her three little boxes and check them off every day, day in and day out, like me. I like to do that. She doesn't like to do that. So, you know, there are different ways in that feelers then can relate. Let me throw up a, that's not a really good way of putting it. Let me put an overhead on the, put up an overhead. That's what I wanted to say. Not throw up a. Okay. Here's a little diagram or overhead. You may want to. Bill, can you turn on the gutter lights and turn off the overhead lights? Huh? Is that better? Okay. This is just a little diagram to begin to help a feeler. One of the diagrams that I show feelers now about, you know, how do you deal with feelings day in and day out, day in and day out, and what's actually happening. And it is a little complex or a little complicated, so I'll walk us through that in just a minute. Can you all see that okay? Okay? In this thing here, let's just say, on this diagram, we're going to start right up here. Let's say the sin, Satan in the world, which we call the unholy trinity, okay? Let's say he spits a lie. And we are impressed somewhere, perhaps in the mind, we're impressed with a lie. And let's take a lie like, and it's always in the first person singular, with an Okie accent, if you happen to be Okie, Oklahoman. He says, I am unloved or unworthy or something like that, or I'm a failure. Okay? So you got that impression, that mental impression. And so you're impressed with the lie. Well, what happens is with the mind then, that of course that's where the impression comes. Now, emotions then react to the mind. You remember what I said, that behind every emotion was a thought? So guess how a person starts feeling right at this point here where the emotion is reacting to what the mind's telling them. How do you think they start feeling? Depressed? Unloved? Right? It can be a lot of different things, really. But in general, you know, you'll tend to feel that which is true of the lie. So the lie is, I am unloved. Guess how you feel? Unloved. That tells you that you've been told a lie, that you're not loved. Now, just step back for a second. Is the is the believer in Christ loved or not? Okay, John 3:16, we know they are. You now, your spouse may be telling you that you're unloved, okay? So you may be getting a real message from your spouse. That's true. Okay, so your mind says, I'm unloved. It's just mimicking what Satan spit in there, and your emotions are starting to feel unloved. And that's kind of what I call the discernment stage. I begin to discern what's going on. I'm feeling unloved, therefore I must be thinking I'm unloved, so I must be tempted with that thought. Okay, you with me so far? So we come down here, and then in 2, and let's kind of ignore this part here, let's just assume that I'm on autopilot now. I'm not doing anything with that emotion or that thought. Well, then I can embrace or believe the lie. And I basically call it mimic. I mimic it. I am unloved. See, I'm feeling that way. And I am unloved. I am unwanted. I am worthless. So then you find that your mind and emotions continue right on down to what I call the symptomatic stage, where you start beginning to see some symptoms. So if I'm feeling unloved and I think I'm unloved, then I'm going to take some kind of action. Well, where do I go to get love? Well, depending on your background. Now, I tell you one place where I used to go, well, sometimes I still do go to get love. My mother, I was born, raised on a farm. And actually, I was born in a hospital, but I was raised on a farm. But my mother, we were not a real prosperous farm family. So in order to show love, my mom would make cinnamon rolls. Now, what would happen if you didn't eat her cinnamon rolls? You didn't receive her love. So, and I'm not blaming my mother for this. I'm just saying the truth is that she had a very willing person in me. I ate her cinnamon rolls gladly. But I began to equate love and cinnamon rolls. See, if I didn't eat them, then that would communicate I didn't love her. So somehow I was connecting a physical need for food with a emotional provision of love. So if I started feeling like I'm unloved and unwanted, unaccepted, the refrigerator looked pretty good. Now, question, how much love can a piece of pizza give you? Well, zero. So in my infinite wisdom, I conclude that maybe 2 or 3 pieces would give me some. Right? So that's, by the way, sometimes your compulsive behaviors come from this kind of a thing where you're trying to. So I start eating, I attack the refrigerator, okay, so forth, so on. So I act out on that, it doesn't work, and then of course I'm totally out of control, and it begins to prove the very thing. I mean, who's going to love the fat boy? And so I create a habit then of overeating, and I prove the very lie that I'm trying to get away from to myself. I don't like me. And it's hard to get a date or something like that. And so it creates a past, and then Satan essentially for himself, he can bow out because now I've got a past because of all this stuff that's gone on. And then all I have to do is look at my past. And I'm just cycling around and around and around what we call here the deception cycle. Okay? And that's basically how it works. Now, here's the interesting thing though. Back here at the discernment stage, there are basically 2 things that I can do. Number one, once I sense that I'm feeling unloved, then at that point, I can then choose or refuse, if you will. I can judge my thought. I'm feeling unloved, but I know that God loves me. So the truth is, John 3:16 and so forth and so on, and traditionally we've been taught to judge our thoughts. That's what you need to do. Recognize your belief and judge your belief and confess the truth. God does love me. I am loved in Him. I may not be loved out here in my family or whatever, but God does love me. I am perfectly loved by Him, 100%. So I judge the thought. Now here's the problem with that, is that the emotions, meanwhile, keep going right on down the line. I'm still feeling unloved. And some point in here, generally, the emotions reconvince the mind, and then the mind says, well, now maybe you really are unloved, you know. And so if I'm not careful by just judging my thoughts, I have to be careful to also judge my emotions. See, not all emotions are true. So if I've got a lying thought, I probably have a lying emotion. And so I choose, or I refuse then, if you will, or deny, if you will, the emotion. So what I'm saying about when I say deny emotion, I'm not saying this. I'm not saying to deny the existence. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying to deny the control. Okay? So it's just denying the control, not the existence. So I come before God and say, God, I'm feeling unloved. I know that it's not true, but I also have the emotion of not feeling loved. And you know, I really wouldn't mind if you brought my feelings in line with what the truth is, which is that I'm loved today. But I'm not gonna go out and walk. I'm not gonna attack the refrigerator or my wife or somebody else to try to get love out of them. The fact is, I'm loved. And so I go out and walk by faith, and my feelings may not change until some point later on during the day. And the fact is that I am loved. Now, the interesting thing about this is you can change the whole thing around. Instead of the unholy Trinity, let's put the Holy Trinity here. God, Jesus, and the Holy Spirit. And they impress me with the truth. You are loved. I embrace and believe the truth. I act on the truth. I prove the truth. I create a truth past. And it just continues into a wicked cycle of believing the truth. Which would be kind of nice, wouldn't it? And that whole thing. So one of the things that feelers must learn is to judge their emotions. Now here's another way, or another illustration that I share with feelers in general. And this is basically true about anyone. Let's just say truth X here, which is John 3:16, which God so loves the world, and we're part of the world, so God loves you. Here's what a typical feeler will do, or they don't really realize they're doing. They look to this thing here to determine whether or not this is true. What do you think that is? Well, emotions or feelings. If the emotions say no, guess what most thinkers do? They come over here and they cross out, God loves me. Well, God must love them, but He doesn't love me. What they've just said now is their emotions must validate truth in order for it to be true. Right? So which, in this part here, which is all important? God's truth or emotions? Well, it's emotions. So, emotions are God. For them. It's more important than Scripture. More important than what God says. And so that's the caution that we have to have is that I have to be careful that I don't look to my emotions to validate God's truth. The fact is God loves me whether I feel like it or not. The fact is that I'm holy and righteous in Christ whether I feel like it or not. Or act like it or not. That's my basic identity. And so if there's something, if I look to my emotions and emotions say, no, God doesn't love me, here's what I have to teach a feeler. Something's wrong with your emotions. Nothing's wrong with this over here. So ask God to transform your emotions. And it's an interesting thing. Many of you have seen the little... I've got to take, by the way, a course on art or something because I can't draw worth anything. How many of you have ever seen the little train illustration with that Crusade puts out, fact, faith, and feeling? So you've got the fact here, you got your faith here, and the feeling comes along for the ride at the end. Well, when that train is making a curve, there's a point here when the train's making the curve, that there's an interesting phenomena going on. And that's what it is the feelings are going this way, and the truth and the fact in your head's going this way. So, as you begin to turn, as you put your faith in the facts, and you're doing a turnaround, if you will, and you're totally turning, there's a point in your experience where your emotions are saying one thing, but the truth is just the opposite. Now, the second then, if that begins to happen, what a lot of people do is then they put their faith back in the caboose, if you will, and they drag the train right back the other direction. Right? But if you continue putting your faith in your fact, what's going to happen eventually to the train? It's going to totally turn, and both your mind and your emotions will be going in the same direction. Now, here's why that's important. My older brother, had a young son named Sean, and he had one time we were in his office, and he had a Snickers bar sitting there on the desk. And this Sean was about 5 years old, and he was standing there, and the desk was about this high to him, and he was sitting there, and he was just staring at the Snickers bar, just staring. You know, standing there, you know, you get saliva, you know. He's just staring at that Snickers bar. And my brother, in a very, very harsh, very uncaring voice, said, "Sean, you eat that Snickers bar." It was a terrible command he gave him. So why did he smile and grab it? See, his mind wanted the Snickers bar, right? His emotions wanted the Snickers bar, right? How hard was it for him to activate his will? Especially with the harsh and cruel command of his father. Well, see, that doesn't make any difference. If your mind and your emotions are going the same direction, obedience is easy. That's not the difficult part. And so that's why it's important that we continue to focus on truth, because truth will eventually lead us emotionally to where we belong. But if I continually focus on the way that I feel, then I'm doomed to live by the feelings. It's like the dog who wakes up and looks at its tail to see whether it's happy or not. Am I happy today? Well, it's not wagging. I must not be happy. You know, looking at their tail. And so we can live by our emotions, but it will definitely be a trip, so to speak. And a trip that we may not want to take. I wanted to read a few things about. There is also something about feelers. I put together a little thing on feelers and vacations. Oh yeah, recreations. Yeah, recreation and feelers. This is something a little extra. Anything people intensive. Most feelers like to have people intensive recreation. You know, unless they're peopled out. If they're peopled out, they don't want that. They enjoy variety and change. They don't necessarily like planned vacation. Now, my wife and I hit this on our first anniversary. I'm thinker, she's a feeler. So we got to this, one of those holodome types of places in Nebraska. It's still cold out. It was in May, and it was still kind of cold weather and stuff. And so we got to one of these holodomes and things. And, of course, what's in her mind, it was like, okay, now, we get to this holodome here, and then we're going to go, let's go window shopping over here, and let's go to this shop over here, and let's do this, and then we'll go swimming, and then we'll, you know, and walk along the deal, and then we'll go. And she had all these plans, okay? So for her, recreation is a change of activity. You're active over here at house and work and job, and you recreate, you go over here and be active over here. For a thinker, recreation is a cessation of activity. You're active over here, but then when you come over here, you want to sit by the pool, sip on a squirt, and, take a nap and read a good book. Now, that sounds pretty exciting, doesn't it? So we had this major blowout on our first anniversary because she had all these expectations that we're going to be doing, and I just got tired thinking about it, you know. About doing all those things. So now we have to plan our vacations accordingly. They like adventure, especially when following a leader, and they tend toward high-energy vacations unless they're burned out. So they tend to like those kinds of things. Okay? That's the feelers. Now, let's talk about... Well, there's one more thing about feelers I wanted to add here, is that feelers have a need to express. You know, remember how thinkers had a need to give you all the reasons why for any particular thing? Well, feelers have a need to share all their feelings with you. So they have this real need to express. And in fact, they're the ones who probably was written of that impression without expression leads to depression. Probably was for feeler. Now, I know it's more for everybody, but that's particularly true for a feeler. If they're impressed with something and they don't get an opportunity to express it, they feel like they're going to explode. They got to tell somebody. Now, I was counseling a fella who is a computer programmer. So he sat in a cubicle all day long at Martin Marietta programming. He was a high, like a 14 feeler. Now, what he had to do, though, is he got 10 minutes every hour for a break. So it was time to the minute. And as soon as his 50 minutes was up, he was up like a thing. He was either on the phone, he was walking around socializing with everybody, and when the buzzer went off again, he was right back at his station. So he had to, he just couldn't stand it. He got to get up and express something. So it would just drive him crazy. So anyway, that's how you can begin to compensate for some of that. Now let's look at the doer real quickly. And we might even get the doer done before the break. And we have a few doers in here. Remember to kind of mark through if you identify with some of these traits. The doer, of course, because it's will, they're very strong-willed type of people. They like to accomplish that task through people. And again, it has to do with impacting another person or their environment. They project a sense of confidence and independence. They enjoy glory stories wherein they are the hero. You know, they don't mind telling you a good story that they're the hero of it, right? They cannot see obstacles. And whether it's cannot or will not, I'm not sure. But most doers, you know, don't confuse me with the facts. I know what I want to do. And so let's get after it. Well, if a doer and a thinker happen to be married, the thinker will give you 29 reasons why that will fail. And the doer will give you 29 reasons why it will succeed, because they don't want to look at why it will fail. They have a tendency to distort reality to fit their present goals. And I don't know how many doers I've been around that you come through some interaction with another person, they're trying to sell something or convince somebody of something, you come away and they're telling somebody else the story, and you're thinking, now wait a minute, I was there. I do not recognize this story. You know, how did he get that impression from this other person? So, sometimes they tend to distort reality to fit what they want it to be. They tend to have lots of irons in the fire. They're pretty busy. They can be inconsistent because of that. Because, you know, they're pretty inconsistent because they have a lot of things to do. They hate to be confused by the facts. They tend to have immediate explosion, leaving everyone on the ground, and then wonder why people don't get up quicker. You know, they just explode, and it's over. They enjoy a challenge, even if it is a problem they have created. Now, this goes with the second one. They're easily bored. Because guess what they do if they're easily bored? They create a problem. So they can have a challenge. So those things can go hand in hand. And in fact, there's something here I just want to interject right here. Sometimes if a doer doesn't feel like they're loved very much, they get a sense of love from their ability to make someone miserable. Meaning, here's what that means. It's kind of a perverted sense of love, wouldn't you say? Definitely. But what they're saying is that if I have the ability to make you miserable, then you care about me. And what I say is important. So if I can make you miserable, then I'm still important and you still care about me. You follow that reasoning? If you don't, just chuck it out because the doers know what I'm talking about. Okay. They can be out of touch with the feelings of others. They're really not aware of the feeling. Now, doers have an overdeveloped sense of anger. That's the one feeling that they're very aware of because of obstacles. There's a lot of obstacles in life. They often think of themselves in the third person. Ed built this. That's Ed talking to himself. Okay? Has no qualms throwing a parade for himself complete with banners. Extremely energetic, extremely creative. Others are viewed as a tool to be used until broken. You know, and another way of putting it in a positive sense is they see where people fit in the scheme of organizations. They're very good at doing that. They easily accept aggression. In fact, they enjoy a good fight. So they say, you know, if two doers get married, you need to buy them that china that doesn't break. You know, that kind of stuff. That's a good wedding present, you know, and put them in plexiglass window houses and, you know, that kind of stuff, because they can have some good ones. Misunderstanding is when unable to accomplish a goal, then others are blamed. You know, instead of taking the blame, and really, I think doers really have a hard time taking blame. In their more intimate moments with themselves, I think they do. But with their expression with other people, they almost never take blame. So it's a hard thing for them to admit that they're wrong about anything. Though he disregards your feelings, he's not disregarding you. He values loyalty. So we may feel disregarded, other people may feel that, but they're not really disregarding us. Often their perceived harsh responses are attempts to control in order to accomplish the goal. Now, here's an interesting thing. The harder the response, the harder the anger, the more, you know, all that, the more expressive they are, the more insecure they are. You got that? And the weaker they are. Okay? Because here, if you've got this little thing, you say something about them, and they absolutely go nuclear on you, isn't that a disproportionate response to the little irritation? So what are they? They must be really scared that you're getting through to something in order to respond that way. So generally, see, most people think doers are so strong, but actually they're about the weakest ones of all because they've got a lot to hide. And so you just kind of take a little pin and you kind of poke them and just Mount Vesuvius, and you're thinking, why are they so scared? You know, they're really insecure. And so, by the way, that's really helpful for some wives and both wives and husbands to realize about their spouse, because they can then know how to pray for them. They're very insecure people. And in reality, they're very weak people, because they try to overpower people because they feel very threatened. So that's why they have to do that. They're frustrated with a lack of progress, though it always appears he is frustrated. By the way, I can share that about doers, because most doers never come to these conferences. Get 1 out of 100 or something like that come to conferences like this. Besides that, they get mad and stomp out. They're frustrated with a lack of progress, though it always appears he's frustrated with you. He cannot be taken seriously as he takes himself. When a goal is before him, he honestly has difficulty heeding anyone around him. Under pressure, they'll feel caged and begin to pace. They look for a savior to loosen the restraint. So sometimes you come around a doer and he'll gladly give you the responsibility and leave. If he feels kind of caged in on something, they'll gladly give you that responsibility and take off. They can become a loner then, belligerent, under pressure now, assertive, dominant, condescending towards others. In affection, they tend to be outgoing, and this one is kind of the physical affection on demand, is what we talked about. Come here and sit in Dad's lap. Come over here and give me a hug. You know, that kind of stuff. Okay? They need a challenge, others who are straightforward. It's really interesting about most of the doers that I know that they don't pull any punches. You ask them what their opinion is, and they'll tell you. And they don't water it down. They don't even soften it up. They just get pretty surgical with their opinions. But you want to know something? Their phone's ringing off the hook. People want their input. because they know they'll get one. They'll get some kind of input from them, and they'll get a truthful answer that's not going to be, you know, that may hurt, but it'll be truthful as far as that goes. They need a variety. They need freedom from controls and very little supervision. They do like to be, they like the kind of jobs where you have to go out and blaze new trails. They kind of like that. The Amazonian Highway, where would that be? Would that be in Brazil? Is that right? Anyway, so the highway is part of the way through, but it's not all the way through. So they have these things where you get on the highway and you drive the 700 or 800 miles that's finished, right? And then the rest is jungle, rainforest. And then at that point, you hire a guide and buy a gun and you go through the rest of another 200 miles or something through the forest. And this is what he's going to do on vacation, you know, to get away, huh? Betty is not going, no. So anyway, you know, and I wasn't invited. And that's okay, because I would have said no. That's not my idea of fun, vacation. So, you know, they like to blaze new trails. To do something new, do something exciting, do something dangerous. The only thing I ask is that he take out a $1 million insurance policy in my name. So that when something goes wrong, you know, well, anyway, you know what I mean. And they fear boredom. So they avoid boredom at all costs. The failure of accomplishing all tasks. They fear the failure of accomplishing all tasks and goals. They fear routine or giving control to another. And this is really, if they fear giving control to another, guess what they struggle with in their relationship to God? God's kind of a controller, don't you think? So they fear giving control to the Lord. Relationship with God, they're most pliable when broken. Now, here's an interesting thing about them. When broken, how do you break a doer? Well, you generally break a will, right? But how do you break a doer's will? Through two things, failure and success. Now, which one would you like? Well, personally, I like to experience the success part. But, you know, I tend to experience the failure part. Now here's what I mean, breaking through success. What if everything you did basically turned to gold? What kind of a challenge would that be? After you've made 5 or 10 million, what's the challenge of making another one? Kind of boring. So one guy I know, when I met him 5 years ago, he was broke and bankrupt. He retired this year a millionaire. Don't ask me how I wish I knew how he did that. Because I would kind of like to do that. But that's not the way God's gifted me. And so, you know, that's why I'm talking about through failure and through success. Because success can drive a guy, a doer or a woman doer, into the ground. Because life is not challenging. And I've known pastors like that, that if they've gone and 2 years later, there was no church. There's a church of 500 or 600 2 or 3 years later. And then they get bored with that, so then they go become a youth pastor. This one guy I know went over to be a youth pastor over here. Two years later, they had 600 youth in his youth group. And he would go over here. Every place he went was successful. It just drove him crazy. Just couldn't stand it, because he knew how worthless and how what a failure he was. So he kept looking for places to fail, and he could never find them, because he really knew how to do it and do it well. So that's when they're broken. So God will use both failure and or success. Most people prefer success, I'll tell you that. But he can use both of those. They desire to see the power of God. And you know, I really think there are some doers at the foot of the cross. So Lord, if you come off that cross, let me see your power, then I'll believe, okay? Or I've had some other doers essentially shake their fist at God and say, God, I want a conversion just like Paul's. If you don't give me a conversion just like Paul's, I'm not going to believe you. I want you to knock me off my horse and make me blind. Now, this a fella did this to me recently. Here's the situation. He's had multiple affairs. He's divorced his wife. His oldest son is in prison, and his second son's on drugs, headed for prison. And he's asking God for a sign. Oh, man. I drew that to his attention, and he didn't like that very much. But he wants the sign of going blind and being knocked flat on your face. He wants the same sign as Saul. So he's demanding that from God. They seek God under extreme pressure. They equate the work of God with the personal presence of God. So if God's there, then your toe grows an inch. Or somebody gets saved. Or something else. They want to see the power of God. And so they really respect that part. They really are control people. They respect power and control. Value to the kingdom. They initiate changes. They can be a... Well, let me explain the next one. I think they can tend to be a driver, but what that's saying is they have the ability to motivate people. Instead of getting out in front, they tend to motivate people. So that's more of a driving thing than it is a leading, where they get out and actually do it. They tend to... So that looks negative, but that's not supposed to be that way. It is not sidetracked by the complaints of others. You know, they may listen, but they're not sidetracked by them. They can stand up under the most vicious attacks. You know, and these are the people that you want to send to your business meetings. You know, and so forth and so on. So they kind of like this thing. You know, and that's always been interesting for me is that, well, no, that's a different story. I better go on here. Accomplishes the goal in spite of obstacles. Large quantities of this type of person are not needed. One can keep many people busy. And that's really true. They can delegate. See, my wife is a feeler doer. A gift of delegation. You know, she's got the troops going. See, isn't your wife a feeler doer? Yeah, okay. Vocationally, jobs that present a challenge. You know, if they're a boring job, boy, they don't like it. Jobs that need a vision to be completed. You know, they just don't like the same old type stuff. Inventors tend to be those type of people. Why don't we take about a 10-minute break, and we'll gather back together here, and we'll continue on then with, we'll look at some of the blends, and then we're going to look at how it all fits together. 10 minutes. That's opposed to the spousal unit. You know, we got like to get technical, so you don't have to say him or her. You can say spousal unit. Bring your spousal unit with you, you know, or whatever. So here's some attractions, annoyances then of the unique self, B21. I just wanted to point that or draw your attention to it for a second. What attracts us then to the doer? And these are kind of like, the other way you might want to put that is before you're married and after you're married. Before you're married, the doer, you're attracted to their independence, confidence, and accomplishments. After you're married, you're annoyed by their disregard for feelings of others, including you, and condemning tone of speech, explosions, and egotistical matter. Okay, since there's no doers in here, that doesn't apply. What attracts us then to a feeler is they make us feel good. They're caring, loving, kind, want to please, enthusiastic, and impulsive. But what annoys us is that they're subjective. They hog the conversation. They manipulate, and they oversell their ideas. Okay? Attracts us to the thinker is they're serious, high standards in work, highly intelligent, often talented in the arts, consistent, extremely loyal. What annoys us about the thinker, though, is they move too slow, they won't take a risk, they're critical, unaffectionate, and controls through biting humor. Okay? So that's a tendency of those two. What we're attracted to, what annoys us after we really get to know the people. And there's a little section in here at the end of B which talks about... A little section about children. Well, actually, it's towards the end of the blends, but it's important information in, you know, B34. But I just wanted to make, you know, you can read just as well as I can, but I did want to make a few comments that, in my family, to give you some of the ideas of the diversity, B34, we're not going to actually go through it, so you really didn't need to turn to it. But that's where the section is. That in my family, again, I'm a thinker, feeler. My wife Pam is a feeler, doer. My oldest son Benjamin is a thinker, doer. And my youngest son Zachary is probably a feeler, thinker. So we have every blend. None of us are the same, which is kind of interesting. Now, what if we tried to raise both sons the same? It doesn't work. And so some things with Zachary being a feeler does not have thinking that sequential type of thinking almost. He can only hold so much, like one command, and he has trouble with that one. So if you say, go up the stairs, find your shoes and put them on, now you've just gave him three things to do. Halfway up the stairs, he finds a G.I. Joe on the stairs and he's playing with it. And now he's forgetting. It was kind of like, you know, that one joke that you hear about the Alzheimer's patients. So they, am I going up the stairs or down the stairs? You know, I'm not sure. And, I'm not sure what I'm doing in this situation. So anyway, he gets there, and next thing you know, you find him, and he's playing in the middle of the stairs with a G.I. Joe. And you said, I thought I told you to go upstairs, get your shoes, and put them on. And he goes, oh, yeah, that's right. That's what I was supposed to be doing. So he gets up there, and then he's playing in his bedroom because right by his shoes was something else. You know, and I mean, it's very, very frustrating. You want to write these things down for him. So anyway, one suggestion that is real helpful. Did you ever see the movie the Home Alone kid thing where he had that little tape recorder that he recorded? They really suggest you do that with children like that, that you record the instructions and then you give it to them so they can play it over and over again and remind themselves what it is. Now, I just think that would save you a lot of time, wouldn't it? And a lot of energy and anger. Play this over again. They'd forget that. You know, what am I supposed to do? Yeah. Play this over again. So, you know, and yet my older son Benjamin, you can tell him what you expect from him and he'll get up and do it. And it's no big deal. And he can take a list and he might even add a few to it himself. Now, Benjamin then also has an active imagination. So occasionally as a parent, you can use that against him. So one time we were sitting out, there's this little thing right over here in the grass, and we were out here at the retreat center, and Benjamin was getting off by the close to the trees. He was about 3 years old. He's a thinker, so he got some, and he's a doer, he wants to go do stuff on his own. Doesn't need somebody around necessarily. So anyway, you know, he was getting off towards the water, then off into the trees there, and he's, you know, 3 years old or something, and I was talking to this fella, and I said, excuse me for a minute. And I went, Benjamin, watch out for the... And then I just turned and I started talking to this guy again, and we had a conversation. And finally the guy said, why didn't you just tell him what to watch out for? And I said, well, just watch and see. And then Benjamin was down to get farther and farther away and finally got in the trees, and then pretty soon I heard, watch out for the what, Dad? And I didn't say anything, you know, and we just kept talking, and pretty soon in a higher pitched voice, watch out for the what, Dad? And then pretty soon he's running full speed right back. And I said, well, I couldn't have thought up anything that would have brought him back near that fast, so I just let his own imagination take care of that for me. So anyway, you know, you can use some of these techniques very good here. We'll probably have to deal with the damage later. But you see, you don't parent. See, one thing about Benjamin then is he has an overactive conscience. And so he's hypersensitive to a lot of things. Now, he has trouble sometimes with the doer part of him, but he does have a very sensitive conscience. And so when he's done something wrong and he is absolutely flagellating himself, totally destroying himself, the last thing he needs from me is to come in and get a good whipping. Really. Because he's already destroying himself. In fact, I've got to almost step in and keep him from destroying himself. You know, in his critical everything else. But my youngest son, If he can get away with it, he's going to try to get away with it. He needs that extra added input, whatever you want to call that, to help remind him to keep on the right, straight and narrow. So how you train your kids, how you discipline your kids, how they learn can be totally different by the way they are. And I don't, why don't you be like your sister? Why don't you be like your brother? Well, you're not like your sister or brother. I don't want them to be that way. And so it can give you a little added insight into raising children. Now let's turn to section C. I wanted to look at tonight, for the last hour, to look at an interesting thing. Now, how do I begin to put some of the unique self together? And the thing to remember here is that even if you can't characterize necessarily your unique self and all that kind of stuff, it's helpful for understanding. But as you well know, you've made it long without understanding a lot about it, unique self to begin with, right? And so, as you know, it's not crucial to live through life. It's just helpful, and it just helps you understand people a little bit better. But one of the things on page C3, then, you'll find basically the same diagram as here. And let's say in block A, then, what we tend to have, when people come in and we start talking to people and help them understand what their flesh is like, we use this diagram that you have on C3. And you'll see, hopefully, just how helpful the material is. So in A, then, come the characteristics of the thinker, feeler, or doer. And so let's say we have this little thinker, feeler person, gal. Okay? So if she's a thinker, feeler, what's true about her? Give me some characteristics of a thinker, feeler. What is their identity wrapped up in? Two things. What? Okay, task and acceptance, right? Or relationships. Okay? What kind of an atmosphere will a thinker feeler want? What do they get security in? Sorry? Peaceful, that's right. Okay? You get security in peaceful surrounding. What else? How about structure, right? Consistency, some of these things. Now let's say that she was raised in a home, let's say her dad was an alcoholic, that he was angry and mom and dad fought a lot. Let's make mom very critical and demanding. Now, those are just some unique hurts, unique things that happen to this little thinker, feeler girl. Okay? She needs that security, peaceful structure, her task, acceptance in her relationship. So she's got this dad that's an alcoholic and he's rather angry. So if dad's an alcoholic, what are the chances are that she's getting a lot of structure at home? Well, you know, they're not very great. She may have some structure, but not a lot of structure. And of course, if he's angry and things are going out of control, is that very peaceful? No. Okay. How about mom being critical? What does a criticalness do to a little thinker's task? That didn't go over very well, does it? When all this criticism that they're getting. Now, I'm sharing this we're not trying to blame mom and dad. We're just trying to find out how those messages made the person feel. Okay? We're not blaming anybody. Now let's look at this for a minute then. Let's say these are the hurts then, and some of the identity messages, we're going to look at what they get from those actions that happen. Now let's look at the list then on C. You look on your page there, and giving the circumstance that I've given you, okay? What messages would you, as an enemy, come along and whisper to this little gal? You know, what would you tell her about herself? How would you make her feel? Okay, which ones of those over there would you do that? Okay, worthless because their tasks are unacceptable, right? Okay, what else? Something's wrong with me. I don't even know what it is. Criticism? Can't do anything right? I'm insecure because of this situation. I'm a failure. See, I'm getting criticized for my task, so I must be a failure. I cause misery. You know, why does Dad have to drink? I must be really driving. I must be pushing some buttons or doing something. Okay. I'm unlovable, unacceptable if all that other stuff is true. Just circle all of them. That's right. See, you could get all those messages from just that, couldn't you? Now, here's an interesting thing. Almost invariably, if someone's a predominant thinker, they'll feel they're stupid. Because remember, they always focus on what they don't know, not what they do know. So if all this stuff is happening, they're probably trying to fix it and they don't know what to do, so they feel stupid, too. Okay? A little bit slow. Sometimes it feels stupid because if you ask a thinker a question, what's their response? They just stare at you. Now here's why they stare at you. If you really haven't figured this out, go up to a thinker and say, "How are you?" The thinker immediately goes, "How am I physically? How am I mentally? How am I emotionally? How am I spiritually?" And then all of a sudden you've got yes, no, yes, yes. So they could answer yes, okay, not so well, okay, not so well, you know, or something like that. They don't know quite what to do. That is just too much input. How are you? So they lie. And they say, "I'm fine," you know, or something like that. Okay. Now here's an interesting thing. Aren't these all feelings here? Right? And every feeling, the reason we ask people about their feelings again is to bring them to the thought behind the feeling and ultimately then to the belief system. Okay? And in particular, let's say this is Susie. We're trying to bring Susie to understand what her belief system is about Susie. What's really true about Susie? What has she been brought up to feel about herself? Now, so far, all we've looked at then is unique self, some hurts, and some possible ways that she feels as a result of that. These are all within the ballpark. They definitely are. Now, here's one of the here's how some of this stuff ties together. Our self-image, which is these things over here, how we feel about ourselves, is a product of interacting with imperfect people. Would you admit that these people giving the hurts over here are imperfect people? They are. And as a parent, I'm an imperfect parent. I wish I were perfect, but I'm not. So these are imperfect people over here. We're not trying to blame them. And so as a child interacts with imperfect people, they get some feelings about themselves due to certain circumstances. Now let me back up just for a second. If we could have taken this child and place them on a deserted island, I know that's not possible, but if you could do that, and they could somehow grow up without any human beings around, or even not the knowledge of human beings around, it'd be interesting to find out what kind of a person they turn out to be. Because they wouldn't necessarily know to walk upright. They wouldn't know what a person does. You know, I mean, they just wouldn't have that frame of reference. So, see, the term self-image has itself come under scrutiny lately because some aren't even calling it self-image anymore. They're calling it others' image. It's an image that I receive from other people. And so, of course, if you were raised on a deserted island, you'd be comparing yourselves with palm trees and orangutans and all other kinds of things to find out what's true about you. Okay? So as a child grows up, he's comparing or she's comparing themselves with their parents and brothers and sisters and how people are treating them. That's what they're comparing them with. So that's where some of these come in. It's not to determine blame, but it's just to see some of the feelings. So let's just assume then Susie here is feeling at all these things at her worst. She's not feeling all these things at the same time. Right? That'd be pretty difficult. to handle. Now, what do you think would be some typical mechanisms in Dee that she would try to use to try to change? What do you think she'd try to do to try to change? Look on your paper. Let's say three things there. What would she do? Okay, you'd be people-pleasing because maybe of her feeler, right? Because that's what they want to do. Now, what would people-pleasing do to fix this? Okay, she wouldn't get that kind of criticism. So she might, if she pleased people, then they may treat her of worth and value, right? That she wouldn't be a failure. If she wouldn't be unlovable, they'd love her then. So forth and so on. Okay, what else would you tempt her to do? Work harder. Work harder? Okay. Because of that little thinker, don't you think? And you might even want to tie work harder and performance there together, right? Some of those are synonyms. They work harder with that little thinker, right? Performance, their task equals their identity. So what I'm going to do, what am I going to do? Well, do good in school, go to church regularly, pray regularly. You can even add some spiritual things in there, but I'm going to do all this stuff because I don't like feeling this way about myself. Okay, you with me on this? Okay, now you may even do things, if she's a little thinker, she's probably going to start reading some books, don't you think? I'm going to start reading some books. In fact, now why doesn't any of this stuff work, by the way? What kind of people are you trying to please? Imperfect people. What are the chances of getting perfect love and acceptance from imperfect people? Zero. Okay, when you're performing and working harder, who you're performing and working harder for? Imperfect people. What are the chances of getting perfect love and acceptance from imperfect people? By working hard? See, even if she worked really hard, if Dad came home drunk, what difference is that going to make? He may just be in a bad mood for some reason. Who knows? He doesn't have to be drunk. He just could be in, you know, something happened at the job and be angry with something. Do what? That's right. Prayer and vows. God, if you change my father, then this and that. Okay. No, I just left the lid off. Okay. So these things here will eventually fail. They will fail in and of themselves. They won't work perfectly. Now here's an interesting thing too to think about. Why doesn't reading books work? Well, these again are feelings that come from past experience. Pretty soon you won't be able to read anything up here, by the way. But these are feelings that come from past experience with what? Relationships. Now you tell me, in reading books, how relational is reading books? It's informational. These are relational problems, not informational problems. These things help. I'm not saying that information doesn't help. But information is not going to solve a relational problem. You may learn about it, but these problems can only be fixed in a relationship, capital A, capital R, which we're getting to. That's part of the solution. Okay? So I'm jumping way ahead there. So these things will fail eventually. And when they fail, then I've got to cope in some way, shape, or form. Now, when they fail, it's kind of like putting two quarters in a Coke machine and not getting a Coke. How do you feel? Cheated. When I was at Iowa State University, I was walking in this dorm and going up the stairs, and it was one of these where it just wasn't a tight stairs going up, but you actually had to walk, and they had this ugly, ugly, ugly plywood thing built right up in the middle of the stairwell. I mean, it was the ugliest thing you'd ever seen. And I said to one of my friends who lived in that dorm, I said, "What is this thing doing in the middle?" And he said, "Well, there used to be a Coke machine on the third floor." Well, One day, it didn't give somebody a Coke, so they took it over the stairwell and dropped it down the stairwell. So to stop them from doing that, they built this wood, ugly wood thing up to the top so they couldn't drop the Coke machines from the third floor down to the basement anymore. Anyway, that's called anger. They're angry because they didn't get their Coke. And so so when things fail, when I put my two quarters in, when I try to please these imperfect people and I don't get it, I get angry because it's not working. Now, all anger is a blocked goal. All anger. Whenever you see anger in your life, there's a goal. Some goal's been blocked for you. So there's an obstacle there someplace. Now, if this room caught on fire and there was just one way out, and I stood in that way and wouldn't let you out, the hotter it get, the hotter you'd get. Right? And I'm not talking about temperature either. So all of a sudden, you'd be acting pretty unchristian-like to get me out of the way. Because your goal would be to get out of here and to get safe. I was blocking your goal. And so pretty soon, you're not acting like my brother or sister in Christ. You're being very mean and rude to me because I won't get out of your way. Well, that's all this is to say is whenever we see anger, we see a blocked goal there. There's something that I want from somebody or something, and it's not happening. So eventually, then, we have to, and the word, the secular word is cope. The biblical word is idolatry. We've got to somehow cope and deal with life. Now, there's an interesting, there seems to be some interesting ways of coping. Okay? And you see a whole list there. If she's a thinker, what do you think would be her primary way of coping initially? What's she going to do? What is a thinker going to do? Okay, fantasize. She's going to do that. She's going to read, right? There's some different ways of coping. I'm trying to find a blank sheet here. There seems to be kind of a pattern in the way that, and we're looking at number E here, there seems to be a pattern when I look to E, especially with thinkers, and we're going to be looking at the different ones. Here's what a lot of thinkers do initially. Most thinkers initially withdraw. If I'm getting rejection, if I'm feeling unloved up here, unacceptable, unwanted, like a failure, who's giving me those messages? These people, aren't they? So a thinker doesn't mind being alone anyway. They don't necessarily, to rejuvenate, they like to get away from people. So the first, this is, by the way, a cave. If you haven't figured this out, this is a cave. A cave here. So they run and they hide in their cave. Okay? So they withdraw. The purpose of their withdrawal then may be to get alone. So they're not getting all these messages. Now, occasionally, they marry somebody who doesn't let them be alone. So they go in their cave and the spousal unit comes in after them. Okay? So they come in there, and they're coming in the cave hunting for them. So if their goal is to be alone, what do they have to do? They got to chase them out of the cave. Well, how do they do that? Well, they get critical of others. They get moody. You know, who wants to be around a moody person? Right? They give blame. Start blaming them. They may even explode to try to drive a person away. They may even begin to do some of that stuff. What's the purpose, though, is to keep them away, right? So let's say that they're alone and they've finally succeeded in driving everybody away and they're by themselves. Who do they find is in the cave? Themselves. So guess who they turn their attention on? Themselves. They become critical of self. right? Now they start taking all the blame. Okay, that's where you get into some of this, what I call the self-hatred cascade. They condemn themselves, which then often sometimes leads to self-hatred, which is then can lead to the suicidal tendencies. Okay? I mean, does that make sense? They're thinking about themselves, everything they did wrong. And they can even, at this point, they can even start to worry. What's going to happen? I can become very anxious. Well, then, eventually, they're alone. They've driven others away. They've analyzed until they're just a heap. And then they need to escape. And how do they escape? We had some of these escape mechanisms. Well, they read, right? Go to TV. Now again, there may not be anything wrong with any of these, but I can use them for an escape. That's where the fantasy comes in. See, fantasizing is, I can't live and deal with my world, so I'm going to make up a world, and I'm going to live there. Do a little bit of daydreaming, that kind of stuff. Okay? Some people like to spend money. That's the way they escape. By the way, how does spending money, how is that an escape? It makes you feel good for a while. If I feel unloved and I go spend something on me, what have I just proven? That I'm loved, right? So I like it. Somebody loves me, it's me. You know, buy something nice for me. Okay? So then you can see that's where I put all in here the DSR&R. What is DSR&R? Drug, sex, and rock and roll. Okay, that's all that stands for. It's the various different coping mechanisms. The ways of escaping and basically getting away. Okay? So those are some of the things that happen in E. In the way of where I'm just trying to cope with and deal with life. Now here's what I want you to note. This tends to be a thinker pattern. It varies from all people. Feeler patterns tend to do this number one, and they manipulate. So they tend to get critical of others and moody, and they try to control and manipulate others because the first thing they attack is relationships. Then when that doesn't work, they try to generally figure themselves out, take all the blame, get into all this stuff. When that doesn't work, they tend to withdraw, and then they escape. See what I'm saying there? So they do some of the same things, but they just do it in a different order. And then doers, many times, kind of leave this part out. They don't necessarily, they tend to run and not withdraw, but they can get very critical of others and they tend to escape fairly quickly. That's what doers do. Okay? So in that, whatever Susie did here, and let's just say she did some of these, like withdrawing and went to TV and reading and tried to maybe even control, become a little moody, reject others and explode once in a while and that kind of stuff. Now all of a sudden, she's getting a message that's even greater than the message that she received from her parents or anybody else because it's coming from her. She's feeling this stuff about her. She's doing these things. She's failing to do it, and here she is withdrawing, exploding, becoming moody, escaping through television, reading, maybe eating, a number of different things. And now she's getting messages from Susie, which are even stronger than the messages she got from Mom and Dad. And she's actually proving these things really are true, aren't they? Who would love someone like me? I'm really stupid. I know better than to do this stuff down here. I know better than to go here. I can't really do anything right. Look how much misery I'm even causing myself now. I can't do anything right. And what you'll find is this person then cycles on and on deeper and deeper down into depression and despair and just kind of sense of a hopeless helplessness. Like I said, when I get done, you won't be able to read any of it. Okay, does this make sense? How the thing functions? Now, this is the bad news. Okay? Now I'm going to want you to take about 5 minutes, and for you thinkers who don't want to mess up your sheet of paper, I have some extra sheets of paper right here. But the rest of you may want to go ahead and fill this out. I want you to think through some you don't have to necessarily list your unique self filters as you just put the characteristics there. And then you go ahead and list a few hurts in your life. And then list some of the messages that you've received. Maybe some things that you've attempted to do to try to change. And then ways that you've tried to cope when all this other stuff has failed. Okay?